want insight and solutions? You're in for a unique experience, one where you're free to ask questions about where you're stuck, ask and hear questions of an everyday variety, global or personal, deep or ancient. All questions are welcome. Any human issue or problem is seen with a new awareness from Patricia's powerful understanding of whole brain thinking. Receive insights you never thought were possible, and be comforted to hear some insights you always knew were right. Discover the profound and the creative value that problems can give us. And now, Patricia Sun.
Welcome to Trust the Problem. And today on Trust the Problem, I'm going to talk about the wonderful intelligence of intuition. And of course, this is a huge subject, and we can go here and there and everywhere. As always, I like to keep the format very open. So if you would like to call and ask a question, the number is 1-877-230-3062. That's 1-877-230-3062. And what I want to talk about is intuition and its importance as intelligence, that it is actually information. It is part of our creative ability, of course. It's the essence, really, of creativity, which I'll talk about. But intuition is what I have tried to delineate in all my work for the last 35 years, teaching about this evolutionary leap that I believe we are in the midst of. This evolutionary leap is one of intelligence. It's one of capacity to perceive. It's about our ability to perceive more. And a huge part of that is intuition. And the only reason it's not only that is that the logical mind also has to mature to allow intuition to interface with it. So I talk about left brain and right brain, and I did long before really anyone else except, oh my gosh, I've forgotten his name now. That's terrible. I always like to mention it because he wrote this book on the hemispheres of the brain. And the one of the things about it is that our culture is pretty familiar with left brain thinking, but right brain is hard for it to grasp. Right brain is the intuitive mind, and the right brain thinks in pictures and feelings and stories and metaphors and myths, and it is intuition. It's visual. It's audio. It can be clairaudience. It can be clairvoyance, clairvision. It can be clairkinetic in the sense that you feel something in your body. One of the ways that I used to get intuitional hits when I was doing family counseling some 35 years ago was that people would be telling me a problem, and I would be searching for some kind of antidote to it. And so in the searching, I would let myself move to what I called my soft mind. The soft mind, for me, was the intuitive mind. It was actually, while it was intuitive, I wasn't thinking of it so much as intuition, probably a defensive block so that I didn't have to deal with the word, because we have so much conditioning against intuition. You know, getting burnt at the stake kind of phenomenon. So we're a little bit afraid of it, or a lot of bit afraid of it. Anyway, I would think of this as my soft mind because that's how it felt. That's how it felt in my body. That's how it felt in my mind, is that I was not striving. I was not grasping. I wasn't trying to control the outcome. I wasn't trying to look right. I didn't look for the right answer. I was looking for anything that would heal the problem that was being presented to me. And the only way you can open the door in your mind to that anything is to let it be soft, not striving. And that's the field, that's the mental field that intuition pops up in. Because intuition is not logical. It is illogical. It doesn't mean it's not illogical. It's just doesn't deal with logic. Logic is an ordering, a sequential thought, hierarchical, cause and effect, did it or didn't it, will it or won't it, right or wrong, for us or against us, black or white. Logic is a form of sorting that tends to polarization when we're immature. But it's a wonderful sorter. It's a wonderful part of our intelligence, obviously. Logic is fabulous. We value it in our culture. But it's amazing to me how contorted we will get with logic, how much we will leave out really important pieces of data to coerce an outcome that we want. So we're really quite illogical in our immature use of the logical mind, because it's very susceptible to denial. It's very susceptible to selective memory, selective selection of information. And so we can get very incorrect, unhelpful conclusions when we have that emotional defense on logic to be right all the time. So what I discovered, and this is the really describing the way I discovered it, because I believe a lot of people who teach these days really just use other people's materials, good things perhaps they've read, and they have an aha, oh, that's a good thing. But they haven't lived it. When you live something, when you discover things through your own experience, which, by the way, always includes intuition, as well as intellect and logic and order, and remembering of data and facts, which is the logical mind. So whenever you experience it yourself through a pioneering kind of, I really want to say courage, a pioneering kind of openness, then this wonderful intelligence comes alive, full bloom, and it's a kind of intelligence that's much, much, much more than a right answer. It's a whole gestalt. It's a whole big interface of a new paradigm, a new point of view. When I first started teaching, I used to sometimes call it a new paradigm because nobody knew what the word paradigm meant. And it's accurate, but it let a kind of fresh start in people's minds, because one of the problems of trying to describe new information is that people put it, they use the words, and they translate it into their old form of reference. And that's why all great teachers and mystics and prophets and Jesus and Buddha and all used parables. And Jesus made a big point of it, that he was going to speak in parable. And the reason is that if you use a story or words that people are familiar with, they don't hear the new piece. They don't grasp the new paradigm. So you have to say it in a story that lets them move to their intuitive mind, that mind of pictures, feeling, and imagery. And when they move to the mind of imagery, the story, the parable, the myth, the metaphor, what happens is that this new, if you pick a good story, I mean, and you create the story out of the experience, then what happens is that they sense the more. This is intuitive thinking at its mature state. The only other characteristic that really hallmarks mature, healthy intuition is that it is guided by inspiration. It is seeking inspiration. Because we always have free will. We always have a choice, whether it's in our logical mind or our intuitive mind. And if we're fear-based, we're sort of monkey-minded. We're at the level of primitive primate. We're at the level of trying to control everything and dominate and have power over everything. And that's very immature, and that's the cause of war and suffering in relationships and bad parenting and every other human problem, really, that we have, is because our basic intelligence is damaged, skewed, twisted in the simplistic, incomplete direction of striving to be right, which is one form of having control, to just the fear-based orientation to life. And that is very unhealthy. And it's why I've often said that I think that the greatest sin that we ever can can do is to promote fear in people. You know, when the situation is genuinely dangerous, and therefore one could understand it perhaps being fearful, our job is to be very lucid, very careful, very specific, and offer all kinds of inspiring opportunities to solve the problem. This is part of the key of our whole show, to just trust the problem, because when a problem comes up, it means you are ready to be creative, courageous, intuitive, see something new, jump the track of the paradigm you're in, and hop into a bigger one. And this is the thinking beyond duality. This is the consciousness beyond duality. This is another form of perception, and it really requires a healthy, intuitive mind, an openness to what intuition is really. So that's the foundation of what we're talking about today, the wonderful intelligence of intuition. It creates thoughts never thought before. It creates insights never realized before. It sees connections never observed before, all of which empowers you to be intelligent, to come to new solutions, to see beyond where you were. This is the great power. This is the wonderful thing that's missing. And when we are immature, and almost equivalent to being immature, is to be, really to say, be fear-based. When we are control-over-based, when we're looking for power and domination and being right as the justification for our power and domination over other people, which you can see in politics all the time, and not only all the time in our country, but every country and through all time, all recorded history, this has been a theme. It is our immaturity. And when we're operating at that level, we cause war, we cause injustice, we cause harm, and we cause a lot of suffering. Now, all that suffering and all that war and all that injustice is a problem. And at some point, perhaps, we will pay attention to the fact that this doesn't work, that this is a problem, and that perhaps we can observe the obvious truth that when we are inspired and not fear-based, we are awesomely creative. We do not do harm. We help. We make ourselves healthy. And, you know, it just the other day, one of my grandkids said to me, "You know, Nana, I think we're supposed to pay attention to what's fun and what makes us happy." And I said, "Well, that's very interesting." And being, you know, the adult, I'm trying to put in a little case for knowledge and learning things. And so I say, "Well, yeah, and but it's also important to study things and learn new things." And he says, "Well, yeah, that's fun." And, oh, I stand corrected. And that's it. That's what it's about. It is fun to discover. When you don't have the baggage, the psychological baggage that says it's either work or it's dangerous or somebody won't like you, but it's just discovery. And that's our brilliance as human beings. That's our wonderful capacity. And so the evolutionary leap that I talk about all the time is one of living on this edge. I call it living on the growing edge. And living on the growing edge came to me because when I was doing family counseling, I noticed how people avoided this sort of unfamiliar edge of participation in life, step by step. And we all know it. We all do it. I still do it. And every time I find I'm doing it, I go, "Oh, no, I'm doing it again." So it's interfacing with the edge of time, if you will, the edge of now. And interfacing with the edge of now with some open-mindedness, with some inspiration, all of which is intuitive mind thinking, is what allows the creation of new solutions and new awareness and new connections and new people in your life and new possibilities about what can be done. And this is very exciting. It's what we are really, I believe, starving to have. And everyone is worried everyone is worried. I see people under so much stress, and people keep saying they're having a senior moment and stuff like this. Well, I want to say a little bit about that, too, because one of the reasons why people get forgetful, and I don't mean the Alzheimer's dementia kind of forgetful, which is a real, I believe, you know, maybe wrong, but I believe that if you keep telling your brain, you don't see this and don't remember that, and we didn't do that, and we did do this when we didn't, and forget that, and this didn't happen, and don't see that. If we keep saying that to our brain, for some people, and you know, and it may be in conjunction with a virus, or it may have some other mechanical, physiological paradigm that it works with. But the reason I really believe people get Alzheimer's is because they don't want to remember. And if you tell your brain this enough, your brain starts shutting off. You know, it's one of those vivid images in 2001, the movie, which shows, you know, he's taking out the parts of Hal's brain, the computer, and because the computer's gone run amok. And so he's trying to survive, and he's trying to just remove these plates. They're like brain cells in the brain. And he just keeps removing them, and Hal gets, you know, slower and stupider and doesn't remember and is incapacitated. Well, this is sort of what we do to ourselves when we have a psychological defense of denial as a way of coping. Now, I don't want to get too heavy-handed on this because it's natural to set aside certain information when it's overwhelming, especially when you're young or you're in a situation where you truly are powerless. It's sort of like the cause or the understanding, the reasoning behind the Stockholm syndrome is people start identifying with their captors because they have to put aside the other realities and logic they would use because they have to survive where they are. And then they start buying into the reality and the logic and the perimeters and the parameters of what's being presented and what they're living in. And so their mind just, it's almost like it's a little bit like split personality. You just drop the other personality and you move into the one that's going to help you survive where you are. And I think that's what is the explanation for the Stockholm syndrome, which is very real. And children all have sort of a Stockholm syndrome because they have to adapt to the family they're in. You know, the neurosis of their mother, the neurosis of their father, the defenses that they may have, the things they can't tolerate to be called on, the things that they need to project out onto others. All of this cripples our capacity to trust the open flow of our mind. And it is in trusting this open flow that the intuitive mind blossoms, because the intuitive mind is not grasping like the logical mind is. It isn't a going out and seeking, and often when I'm speaking in front of people, you know, I like reach my hand out and like grasp something and pull it in. This is what the logical mind does. It's trying to capture data all the time, which is not bad. It's okay. As long as it's honest and open-minded, then it's fabulous. That's what it's there for. In fact, a mature logical mind keeps honest, accurate, I was going to say control, and I don't mean to say control, but I guess I do, honest and accurate remembrance and accounting of facts and data and experience. Now, when we are going through all these other defenses which get in the way of using our intuition, when we're trying to mature beyond them, when we're trying to process them, we run into all kinds of problems, the social problems, interactive problems, emotional problems. And of course, this is why I decided to call this show Trust the Problem, because all these problems set you up to get look deeper and to see it really is about self-contemplation and healing. It is about understanding the patterns of your life. It is about letting go of old defenses by risking living anew, living with fresh eyes, connecting, which is a connection is so powerful. And it is the last radio show I had was called Connection. And the reason is that at a very deep psychic level, we are connecting, as well as at the practical, pragmatic, daily, conversational, interactive work level. We are connecting, and we are connecting not only to one another. We're connecting to life itself, to the plants and the animals. As I said that, my dog just laid down on my foot. He likes to lay a little bit always on me, a little bit, just so he's there. Well, that's that connection. And that was a little synchronistic event, which is another form of connection. There's a connection to the greater whole, the big picture, the flow of the universe, the mind of God, divine order. And that is another form of connection that has its own quality and its own capacities to not only be intelligent and inform you, but to have you interact with the world in a creative and wonderful way. So we're really looking to be more than what we were. That's built in, I believe, in our DNA. It's in our souls. We are here to evolve. All life is evolving. We are no different. And one of the hurdles of this evolutionary leap that we are in the midst of, I believe, is to come to logical, honest, rational terms with the nature of our intuition and what it is and what it really serves. And we need people like me. I have never said this publicly what I'm about to say, and I was going to censor it, and it came up again. And I've learned to listen, and it's somewhat embarrassing even to say it. But if I lived at another time, I would be a prophet. Because prophets are just people who think things ahead of schedule, who process them ahead of time. They're like pioneers. They basically have their intuition open. They're getting inspiration. They run the risks of allowing the intuition to speak to them. They do in their daily lives, the part that's not normally recorded, they do in their daily lives encounter all kinds of problems and difficulties. You know, when we record the memory of prophets, we just see the highlights, like great scientists. You know, we remember the great good things they saw or discovered, but not the work that they went through. And the work is not just work like building something. It's the work of building something while letting yourself be inspired on the most unique new way to build it that's better than ever before. I don't know how else to say it, but I'm trying to create a metaphor that lets you see that going off the beaten track, when your heart says yes, when your body says yes, when you breathe more deeply, when it lets you be more alive, I used to call it follow the juice. When something makes you feel juiced, that's the universe speaking through your body. That's your intuition receiving kinetically. This is something that's going to give you more information. Now, whenever I start talking about this kind of a thing, about how the intuition works and how we get the messages, always rises the problem that when are we fooling ourselves? When are we feeling high or good or juiced because we have a short-term neurotic indulgence we want to indulge? we want something that's really not part of the bigger picture, but is part of our neurotic getting one up on people, feeling more powerful than somebody else, controlling someone else, dominating them. Well, there's the answer. You can tell whether it's a neurotic thing or an inspired thing when you feel juice, when it isn't about controlling other people, when it isn't about dominating anyone. It's about seeing things anew, and it's about creating a new door for you to go through, a new direction, mentally or culturally or with your work or in your relationship. It's running the risk of a new way of looking at it, a new innocence, a new earnestness. You know, there's so many books out on relationships that talk about, you know, the rules and tips, and when you write a book, you know, all the publishers want things categorized, they want it simplistic, They want steps for people to follow. They want it all logical. They want it all linear. And to try to teach the very quality that brings us brilliance, insight, reverie, reverence, joy, numinousness, the presence within you, genius, new ideas, and just plain happiness and fun and aliveness, those qualities, to find them almost always requires that it's not a list, that it's not a technique, that any more than just saying it's about being innocent, it's about being open, it's about following the truth. So at one simple level, you could say that. But then I think it's important to go into the other details, such as I've already spoken about, which let you have a better foundation, a bigger base, a larger foundation upon which to start sorting, so that new information is included in the calculation or in the reverie or in the goal or just in how far you will open your mind. So there is something happening right now on the planet, and it's been happening for the last 30 years, where there's this evolutionary leap at a turning point, a lot like, and I remember once I was in Ireland, and I was staying with some nuns, teaching nuns, where I had given some workshops they had organized, first for the nuns, then for the public at large. And they were very helpful and very interesting, wonderful women, really. Very impressive, their earnestness. And, I mean, I've known nuns who are not so impressive or earnest through my life. But these ladies were quite wonderful. And I remember talking about this very subject, about the change that's happening, that I see it as an evolutionary leap, but that there's something happening in the world that's like a shift point. And she says to me, you know, when you're talking, she said, I grew up in a little village by the sea. And what you're saying to me and what you're describing to me sounds like a very magical thing that not a lot of people know about, but it was very common to us because our village was close to the sea, is when the tide turns. And we've kind of all heard the expression, well, the tide will turn, you know. But what I had been trying to describe to her for psychological inner states when we're making these big shifts, and which is part of the intuitive mind really giving us new insight, there's this place where you don't do anything. You don't do anything. There's no doing at all. It's all letting. And so the analogy, the metaphor, the parable is the wave comes in, or goes out, let's say it goes out. The wave goes out. I think that's how she was describing it. The wave goes out, and then it just, like, stays out. It has this moment where it doesn't come flooding back in. It just stays out a little too many beats where it starts to look a little scary. And then the tide turns. And then from going out, it starts coming in. And there is this moment when the tide turns, when everything sort of stands still, or it looks like nothing's happened. And it's slightly unsettling, and it's powerful. And that's why I think she was thinking of that, why it reminded her, because I was talking about this as a psychological state that we need to respect, that we need to let live in us. We need to have language and metaphor and expansion of awareness, to have some patience with it. Because a great deal of genius and new ideas and healing, physical healing, emotional healing, And intuitive growth comes in a state of letting where it looks like nothing is happening. And our linear mind gets anxious. It says, you're not doing anything. Do something. Figure something out. Hurry up. Do something. And we need a fair amount of time where we're letting. I think of several things as I say that about school. And I was thinking how Einstein talked about learning and how schools were so bad for children and how they damaged this brilliant being called a human child. And his description was a metaphor. And what he said was, if you took the most carnivorous beast there is and you put them in a cage and you force-fed them meat 8 hours a day, it would only be a matter of days that it would cower in the corner at your approach. And so what he's saying is, you take the most intelligent being that we know of and you put him in a room and don't let him move and you force feed them information, the thing they want to have, the meat, the carnivorous beast, we want to know, but you force feed them, we will damage them so much that they will cower in the corner as you approach. And what they do get is what we now call attention deficit disorder, you know, all the letters, ADD, you know, all those letters. And then we give them drugs, and all because we won't change, we won't pause, we won't think for a moment intuitively what inspires us. What is the emotional state that goes on between two people when one is inspiring another, when one is teaching another something the other does not know, and the other is devouring it, is loving it, rather than feeling judged or blamed or coerced or so overwhelmed with the style of communication that they can't hear the communication. This is what has poisoned religions. This is what has poisoned medicine. This is what has poisoned relationships and teaching, academics. This is the problem. We don't understand intuition. We don't let it be there. We don't trust it. We don't trust being inspired. We don't trust the other person to come perhaps to a different conclusion than we do, which may be wrong, may be right, may be partly both. All part of the discovery and the journey, and no real problem at all. But no, we want it like we want it. Teachers want regurgitation. They want things coming back the way they're familiar. Doctors don't want to hear about other ways of healing. They only know the way they know, and if they hear of other ways, it scares them and makes them inadequate. And so that is so terrible. They will torture patients. They will kill patients, and they do. That's not an exaggeration. Hospitals are very dangerous places to go. That doesn't mean they don't also sometimes save lives, do exactly the thing that's necessary, have some wonderful nurses and doctors that on occasion really do exactly the right thing at the right moment, use their intuition, use their knowledge, and it all fits and it works. Of course that happens too, but so does the other. But there's no need for the violation. If we would risk, if we would pay attention, then we have the difficulty of insurance companies and lawsuits and government regulations, and which are all kind of symptoms of immature logical mind trying to control everything and not trusting the intuitive awareness and knowing. And getting back to the innocence of children, when you feel something as overwhelmingly kind or clear or healthy or calming or inspiring, you're on the right track. You know, if you're training a dog or you're training a child, if you yell at them and hit them, you only damage their nervous system. You violate them. You're venting what was done to you. you're feeling powerless, you're immature, and you don't get the opportunity to create understanding for the next step of what would be a better way to accomplish whatever you're trying to accomplish. And it always means self-correction, because we're all conditioned. We've all received violation and neurosis and defense mechanisms of our parents and our caretakers and the other adults around us and the culture at large, and then the variety of dysfunctions that even our playmates or people that are our peers, that they have suffered from theirs. So there's bullying in the schoolyard. There's all kinds of stuff, all of which are completely unnecessary, very damaging, and all we have to do is be awake to it to stop it. It's not hard, actually. It's only hard to let go of where we are and let our hearts open, let our minds open, and be willing to try something and maybe make a mistake. You don't have to plunge in with all of your being right away. You can pick something up and check it out and smell it and taste it and look at it and try it, interact for a while. And if you learn something, be grateful, maybe continue. Something feels not good, stop for a while, reflect on what wasn't good. Was there a new response you could give it that might change it? Maybe try again. If it doesn't get better, it gets worse, remember it, put it on the shelf. Something to look at later. Maybe go on with life, or maybe pursue it. This is the living on the growing edge. This is the living in the now, on the edge of discovery, every moment, a willingness to reflect and contemplate and reframe what you know by including what you've just discovered. Reframe what you know to allow inspiration, to allow the intuitive mind to be the brilliant thing it is, and to bring in new information that you can test, you can check out, you can consider, you can let it expand your mind to a new paradigm. Now, the problem with intuition, of course, is that we're so fearful, one, fearful, that we draw fearful metaphors. And two, we're so fearful and immature and still immature logically, we're trying to control everything. So we sort of strangle things at birth. We get an insight, and that's what dreams are for. They give us practice. We get to dream an insight in many different metaphorical forms until it starts seeping into the logical mind as a possibility, so that when it starts to happen in life or we allow ourselves to remember a dream, we can have insight on it. It can speak to us through the metaphor. It can help us change the way we're holding something. This is the power of dreams. It's wonderful. Dreams are the intuitive mind, which we only let sort of loose in our sleep because the logical mind is sort of resting. And even in our dreams, our logical mind will argue. I've had dreams, especially when I was first opening, where my logical mind said, this must be a dream because this can't happen. And I had to learn to say, well, that's what the dream is for. You get to fly in a dream. You get to turn around and confront a demon or a devil or a person who's chasing you and say, turn into a frog. You get to do whatever you want, which lets you release yourself from the track, the rut of fear. It lets you jump outside the track and be in the meadow and be in the clear space where you can find whole new trails and other paths to where you're going and not waste time in a broken record with a groove stuck, caught in it, just repeating the fear over and over again, or the same mistakes over and over again, or the same desire to dominate and the same patterns over and over again, or the same not telling the truth to yourself and others over and over again. And just look at our culture. Look at the world. We're in this reactionary, psychological reactionary swing. It's in all the countries. It's in all the nations. It's in all the institutions, and particularly in religion, because religion is the link to that which is greater. It is when not made crazy by control and fear, it is the inspiration to love and to do good and to be inspired. And that is the link to that which is greater. That's what religion is supposed to be, and that's what it is at its core. All of the religions of the world are that. But what has happened is through our immaturity, we have, in a logical way, tried to control and dominate everything to the point where we're arguing how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, you know, this famous silliness in the Middle Ages, where there were great big, you know, religious enclaves and enclaves discussing this, meetings. And now, you know, we've got our political organizations diverting into kind of not quite nonsensical things, but narrow views of them, when the bigger picture is too much for us to handle, to take responsibility for the changes we need to make, to take responsibility for softening our hearts and opening to communication and looking at what we might have done in the past that has caused resentment, hurt, or harm. I was hearing someone talking about stem cell research today on C-SPAN, and it was someone who was against stem cell research, and he said, well, you know, you cannot kill human life at all. And then so then a caller on C-SPAN called in and said, well, what about when we go to war and we kill people? And he says, well, that's when we're attacked. We have to defend ourselves. But, you know, that is such a foolish untruth, because in war, almost all the people who get killed are not the people who ever attacked us. It is such coarse thinking. It's so gross in its simplisticness, where one of the things I used to always say that helps solve problems is correction at the source is always the quickest, simplest, easiest, least expensive, least damaging way of correcting a problem. So when it's small, it's easy to correct. The longer we delay correcting it, the longer we delay seeing it, the longer we delay admitting it, the longer we deny it, the longer we project onto other people the complications then that are now burgeoning because we're denying it, the worse, the more damage we create. And it's like an angle, you know, the acute angle, right at the source. It's a little tiny gap. But if you just let it go, goes out into space, goes out into infinity, gets huge, and all this stuff, all the turmoil, all the injury, all the misconnections fill up that space when it was correction at the source. So likewise, when we look at the world right now, and it's in a psychological swing towards simplistic black and white thinking, I think this is a precursor. This is the turning of the tide. Because what's going to come rushing in is the new way of thinking, the next level of being, the next level, next way to see it, which is to not be, because we will learn by looking at the problems we've created, by attacking the wrong people. You know, there's an old psychology story about a man who is bullied at work. His boss yells at him and belittles him because the boss is scared, right? So the man comes home and he yells at his wife. And his wife gets upset and yells at the kids. And the kids kick the dog. And this is the kind of contamination of injury when we feel powerless and we don't claim our power to rectify things at the source, right within ourselves. So if the man at work could say to the boss, excuse me, I see you're really upset about this, but it's very important that you speak to me in a calm and respectful way so we can solve this problem, because I really want to help you. That would be the mature response. If he couldn't correct it there because he was afraid, then he could go, when he goes home, instead of yelling at his wife because dinner's not on time and she didn't do this thing she said she'd do, and, you know, beat up on the wife physically or psychologically or verbally or whatever, if he could say, oh my gosh, I've really had a hard day. This is the thing that happened at work, and it was unjust and was disrespectful, and I help me brainstorm on a way to handle this. That's a husband and a wife. That's a mature response. If the husband couldn't do that and the wife couldn't do that, she could stop and think. Or she could instigate that and say, God, I can tell by the way you're yelling at me, you had a bad day. Tell me what went on. So the person who's not in the mode of being hurt has more power always to help the person who's immediately received the blow and is in the psychological turmoil. So that's a principle of connection. And empathy is a form of intuition. Empathy, feeling the other person deeper, is intuition. It's an intuitional capacity of our intelligence. And it's wonderful. And when we allow empathy, I don't mean just making excuses for people or something like that. It's truly about understanding so that you are in the position of facilitating a healthy change. So following the story down, we could say the mother, say she doesn't get to handle it with the father, and she's very angry, and she's upset, and the kids spill the milk, because the kids are going to feel this too. She could yell at them, or she could say, you know what, kids? Let's go take a walk outside, or let's go take the dog for a walk. Let's go do something to, a lot of stress going on here. Let's change this channel a little bit. What is she doing? As a parent, she's teaching the children that when things are stressful, change the channel. Move, do something, move in the direction of something healthy, anything. Move in the direction of something healthy. And your intuitive will supply the anything. It will tell you, just be willing to change it. And then you go out, and then the air is changed, the husband's home alone, and he can reflect. The mother changes the energy, she teaches the children how to change energy, and the dog gets a walk. This is maturity. This is thinking beyond duality. This is not being reactionary. Reactionary is a problem, whether it's political reactionaryism, which is just a big social construct of the same dysfunction, or reactionary one-on-one, or reactionary in your thinking inside yourself, judging yourself, beating yourself up. Being reactionary has no intuition in it. It has no love in it. It has no solution in it. It has no creativity in it. And it has no options. It's only reacting. You get hit, hit back 10 times more. That's how you get war and injustice and cruelty and suffering until we're all so exhausted. It's such a failure of intelligence till everything is so devastated that we finally say, oh, what else could we do? And then we start opening to the intuition. That's the turn of the tide. And I believe that's where we are in the world right now. And it's happening everywhere. And it's very interesting because first there was all this clumping together on the denial, particularly in America. And then the other countries were telling, no, you're not doing the right thing. This isn't good. Listen, get other people's input. No. We're in charge. We'll do it the way we want. We're the big bully. We're smart. We got money. We can do what we want. So what are we doing? We're bankrupting ourselves. And this is Republicans and Democrats. Democrats they did not play the good wife. They did not come, or some did. And there's always some, by the way. There's always some in the Republicans that try. There's always some in the Democrats that try. But this isn't really about Democrats and Republicans, though it's sort of sorting out that way right now. That's just transitory. You know, several decades ago, the Democrats were different. You know, 100 years ago, they were really different. Everything keeps evolving. You know, I was raised Irish Catholic, and when I went to Mexico, after being raised Irish Catholic in the East Coast in New Jersey, I went to Mexico, and these people are talking in mass, and they're playing with their jewelry, and the kids are running around up and down the aisles, and I was like in shock. You know, I had this Irish Catholic thing where you had to sit quiet, and you know, it was all ooh. And I remember when I was a little girl, when I went to Catholic school until I was in fourth grade, and I used to go after school and pray for the nuns and the priests because I knew they did not get it. I knew they totally did not understand Jesus. And it made me so sad, and I felt so alone. And I would go into the church, which I thought was beautiful, especially when nobody was there. And I would just pray and be filled with Spirit and let it just go out and heal me, really, as much as my desire to heal others. By shifting the way I was thinking, it was healing me. Because while I was alone and while there was injustice all around me, and unkindness and confusion and narrow-mindedness, there was still the sense of that presence. And it's why I've always loved old churches, particularly the cathedrals, because they were built with the Spirit. They were built with that receptiveness to beauty and inspiration. And it creates in physical form a resonant quality that inspires. And that's why beauty is so valuable. And it matters. And it's a guide. It's an intuitive thing. Love is an intuitive thing. Beauty is intuitive. Inspiration is intuitive. These are the qualities that bring us in balance. But they bring us in balance because they let us open up to getting the more, to seeing the more. And that's the wonderful, wonderful intelligence of intuition, because it allows spiritual experience, not spiritual ideologies and rules and dogmas and telling stories, you know, like the New Age. Sometimes I hear people on television who I know have plagiarized a lot of what they teach. They don't know what they're talking about, really. And maybe sometimes they do a little bit. You know, it's never all black and white. But there's a big piece that's dysfunctional because it's based on a dishonest presentation. And it short-circuits the communication, the connection, the resonance, which is part of what we're hungering for. This is part of the intelligence that unifies us, that takes us to this leap to the consciousness beyond duality. This is the power of love. And it isn't about making nice. It isn't about looking kind or speaking in a mealy-mouthed way or having a condescending way that you know the secret and they don't. That's not what it's about. It has a quality of numinousness, of the presence. That's what spiritual experience is. And true spiritual experience is born out of the grief of suffering, some injustice, some reactionaryism, some problem, some violation that allows you to say, I just have to open. I just have to surrender to something bigger once again. Even if you've done it a million times before, you have to do it once again. And it takes you, and it's what Nietzsche, I believe, meant when, I don't know, I'm maybe paraphrasing it or I may be saying it accurately, I'm not sure, but you get it. It's just when he said, you know, that which does not kill us, makes us stronger. So when we survive some great injustice or a disease or a physical world, so funny, I can't think of the word I want to say, like a hurricane, you know, an act of God, I guess they call them, but, you know, some catastrophe, some chaos, some injustice, some war. That which does not kill us makes us stronger. And we are in that moment in our country and in our world, in our species world, in our planet. We are in that collective moment. Young people, this next generation, you know, under 20 that's coming up, under 30 particularly, but then under 20 and then the teenagers, they are all experiencing one world. They are all experiencing a global world. With television, the internet, they see what goes on in different places. They may not get all accurate input because it's so dysfunctional, but they know already the more, the bigger. They know the earth is round. They know something big is happening. They know we're in the midst of an evolutionary leap, whether they call it that or not, because they're living in it. They feel it. And so we are in a crisis. You know, the old Chinese idiograph, I've used this for 35 years. From when Nixon opened to China, I first heard about this, that the ancient Chinese ideograph for crisis is a combination of danger and opportunity. That's the same theme. That when things are bad, when there's a problem, when it looks dangerous, when we've been violated, when people are being reactionary and simplistic and causing harm all over the place, almost wherever they go, they will be violating somebody. Because they're not seeing them. They're not seeing that, you know, sure, when you get attacked, you want to do something to protect yourself. And sometimes it is a physical and even body.